Thanks, Ruth, and thanks for everyone for being with us today. As Ruth mentioned, I'm the lead researcher on this report, and my colleague, Maria Schiff, who directs our work, is out today and so is unfortunately not able to be here. Our project tended to provide a cohesive picture of states' healthcare spending and how it's changed over time. The State Healthcare Spending Project is a joint initiative between the Pew Charitable Trusts and the MacArthur Foundation, and we are a three-year initiative providing that cohesive picture of spending, looking at as comprehensively as possible what states are spending on healthcare across a wide range of categories, which include, just to name a few, Medicaid, state prison healthcare spending, state employee healthcare spending, the Children's Health Insurance Program, mental health and substance abuse treatment. And so to the extent possible, we are trying to provide policymakers with the comprehensive view of what they're spending on healthcare, how it's changed over time, the factors driving that spending, as well as, when appropriate, how states compare to one another within those individual categories. And so state leaders know, of course, that healthcare spending overall is increasing and that it accounts for a substantial piece of their budget each year. The report we are discussing today is part of a series of reports to help policymakers better understand what's driving those costs in specific healthcare areas. And we're looking at policies and practices across the states to show lawmakers how they might better control their healthcare costs while maintaining or improving health outcomes. And today's report looks at an important part of the picture, which is state employee health plan spending, which is second only to Medicaid as part of states' overall healthcare spending. Until now, little has been known about how states' employee health plans and costs compare to one another and to other large private sector employers. But in this first-of-its-kind analysis, we examined each state's employee health plan spending and design characteristics, as well as how states compare to one another and to other health plans offered in the private sector. The result is a nationwide comparison benchmarks never before available to policymakers and other stakeholders. How states manage their employee health benefits, as well as other elements of their employee compensation package, affects states' fiscal health, their ability to recruit and retain qualified staff to deliver critical public services, and their employees' physical, mental, and financial well-being. These plans, along with other employee-sponsored health insurance, are also a critical funding source for virtually every medical institution. To gather spending data for 2011 through 2013, we worked with the global actuarial firm Milliman Incorporated, which maintains a database of public employer health plans. This database contains information that enabled our researchers to determine national benchmarks.
The host has joined the conference.
And to compare states and even health plans within a state. Next slide, please. Our analysis of state health plan spending and plan design yielded the following findings. 49 states spent about $31 billion to ensure 2.7 million employee households in 2013. This was a slight uptick in spending from 2011 and 2012 after adjusting for inflation. The average per employee per month premium for coverage of employees and dependents was $963. States paid $808, or 84% of the total, and employees covered the remaining $155, or 16%. Employees paid an additional $70 per month on average in cost-sharing elements, such as deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance. Next slide. But this average per employee per month premium masks sharp differences across the states. One factor underlying differences in per-employee premiums is variation in plan richness, a commonly used term of art within the actuarial community. Richness reflects the required cost-sharing between an employer and employees based on the health plan's deductibles, co-payments, and co-insurance. We found that state health plans generally had a low level of cost-sharing. using money from employer and employee premium contributions, health plans paid 92% on average of the typical enrollees' healthcare costs in 2013. By way of context, these plans would be designated platinum plans within the new health insurance exchanges under the Affordable Care Act. Annual deductibles are an important determinant of plan richness. Many private sector employers have introduced high deductible health plans in recent years, which result in lower premiums. States have been relatively slower to offer such plans, and in those states where they have been offered, relatively few employees enrolled in them. 19 states offered at least one health plan with an annual deductible of $1,500 or more in 2013, up from 16 states in 2011. Among those 19 states, a median of 7% of state employees enrolled in them. Nationwide, only 4% of state employees enrolled in such a plan. Most employees enrolled in plans with no annual deductible or in plans with a deductible of less than $500. Next slide. Even after controlling for differences among states in health plan richness and enrollee household size, a large range in premiums remains across the states. This suggests that other factors also have a substantial effect on premiums, including regional differences in provider prices and physician practice patterns. A study by the Institute of Medicine found that in commercial health plans overall, including state employee health plans, 70% of regional spending variation resulted primarily from price differences among providers. The remaining 30% was due to differences in the utilization of healthcare services and the local cost of living. Next slide. A third factor that affects costs in the composition of individuals insured by a health plan. Age, gender, and enrollee health status are important predictors of anticipated claims costs and therefore health insurance premiums. On average, healthcare costs rise with age, and women are more costly than men during most life stages. This presents a challenge for because, on average, their insured populations are older and composed of a greater percentage of women than private sector employers. People covered by public sector employers have also been found to have a higher prevalence of costly chronic conditions than people covered by private sector employers, even after adjusting for differences in age and gender. It's important to note that because of these variables, and others that influence spending, higher spending is not necessarily an indication of waste, and lower spending is not necessarily a sign of efficiency. The final piece of our research was to look at some policy approaches states can use to influence costs. While we did not examine the potential health outcomes of these strategies on state employees and their families, I'm sure you certainly would if you were contemplating any change in approach. We are not necessarily recommending these strategies, but encourage states to consider whether they are right for them and their employees. In the interest of time, I will speak very briefly about each strategy, but I encourage you to read the sections of our report that explore them in greater detail, and I welcome questions about these strategies. The first strategy concerns premium contribution arrangements, which can affect employers' total costs by influencing employees' plan selection decisions. Some states base their contribution on their lowest cost plan and require employees who select a higher cost plan to pay the difference in premiums. This can drive more employees to select the lower cost plan. Alternatively, other states contribute a fixed percentage for all plans within a coverage tier, creating a greater incentive for employees to enroll in higher cost plans. The share of premiums employers pay for family coverage also affects employee enrollment decisions and therefore state spending. States usually vary the premium they pay across coverage tiers by paying more for employee plus dependent coverage than for employee only coverage. But a small group of states places a significantly greater share of the premium on employees who cover dependents. This approach can reduce the number of persons covered per employee and in total, and lower the state's total costs. It can encourage an employee with dependents to consider other options, such as a less expensive state plan, the spouse's employer-sponsored insurance, or the new health insurance marketplaces. However, these arrangements can also create a heightened risk that dependents could go uninsured. Next slide. The second strategy relates to states' tier structure, which is the way in which they group premiums for employees with different types of dependent coverage. These are known as tiers. Coverage offered by states is generally structured in one of three ways: two tiers, three tiers, or four tiers. States that offer fewer tiers encourage large households to enroll because their premiums are pooled with relatively smaller households with dependents. This can attract more enrollees per employee on average and raise total costs for states. Alternatively, by adopting additional tiers for households of varying size, states can offer lower premium rates to smaller households than would be available with fewer tiers. This reverses the incentive for employees of various household sizes, which can reduce the number of enrollees states insure per employee and lower total spending. Next slide, please. The third strategy pertains to how state health plans treat pre-Medicare retirees. Over the years, fewer and fewer private sector employers have offered retiree health insurance coverage, either for pre-65 or post-65 retirees. States have largely bucked this trend. In 2013, 43 states offered pre-Medicare retirees and their dependents the same health plans as active employees as part of the state's retiree benefit packages. But they differed in how they set premiums for retirees relative to active employees. Of the 43 that permitted pre-Medicare retirees and their dependents to enroll in active employee health plans, 29 enrolled them at the same premium rate as active employees. Three states set their retiree premiums above their active employees rate, but below what is needed to cover the entire additional cost of insuring these older individuals. 11 states allow enrollment at a separate rate that appears to be intended to cover the entire additional cost of early retirees. Next slide. The fourth strategy has to do with state health plans' cost-sharing arrangements. In addition to shifting some of the cost of care to employees to save state money, cost-sharing can also be used to influence employees' behavior by, for example, encouraging them to reduce their utilization of certain types of care or to explore less costly treatment options and care settings. A majority of state government employees enrolled in health plans that required relatively modest amounts of cost sharing. As I mentioned earlier, the average state government employee was in a health plan that had an actuarial value of 92% in 2013. This means that using money from employer and employee premium contributions, the health plans paid 92% on average of the typical enrollee's healthcare costs in 2013. In 42 states, the average health plan had an actuarial value of at least 88%. Seven states had an actuarial value averages between 80% and 87%. One reason for state health plans' limited use of cost sharing is, as I mentioned earlier, that they have been slower to offer high deductible health plans than private sector employers. One newer development in the area of cost sharing is the introduction of what's known as value-based insurance design, or VBID, which aims to lower cost sharing for services regarded as high value with the goal of promoting preventative or health maintenance services. The fifth strategy deals with the breadth of provider networks. State health plans vary in the breadth of providers they make available to their enrollees. Plans with wide provider networks cover most or all providers throughout the health plan's service area. Narrower networks limit the physicians and or hospitals available to their enrollees, excluding those providers they consider to be unjustifiably expensive. Plans with narrower provider networks either do not cover out-of-network care except in an emergency or require enrollees to pay a higher percentage of the costs for services provided outside the narrower network. In exchange for restricting the available providers, these plans offer lower premiums and or reduced cost sharing than comparable plans with broader provider networks. This strategy can also have the effect of improving a state health plan's position during contract negotiations with providers who have sometimes accepted lower reimbursement rates in return for the plan including it in its preferred network. The sixth strategy is workplace wellness programs. Using these programs, states seek to encourage employees to improve their health as a means of containing costs, reduce absenteeism, and increasing the well-being of their staff members, particularly those with one or more chronic conditions. These strategies take a variety of forms, ranging from using health risk surveys to creating personalized health improvement plans to linking employees' share of premiums to whether they participate in employers' wellness programs and or to various health metrics, such as whether they smoke. This strategy may have more value to state governments than to private sector employers because of state employees' longer average tenure in their job, the fact that, as I mentioned earlier, state governments often retain responsibility for their employees' health coverage even after retirement. Thus, a return on investment in a program such as smoking cessation or weight loss can bring dividends to a state government years after paying for the employee's participation because it is likely that the state will cover that individual for many years to come. The seventh strategy is reference pricing. Under a reference price model, a health plan sets a maximum amount that it is willing to pay for a specified health service. If enrollees receive care that exceeds the reference price, they are responsible for paying the additional amount out of pocket. This arrangement can save money by directing enrollees toward cost-efficient providers and motivating providers to charge at or below the price threshold. For these programs to succeed, employers must communicate the program clearly to employees and assist them in making informed decisions so that they avoid inadvertently receiving care from a provider that exceeds the price threshold. The use of reference pricing for prescription drugs applies to costs that have a generic or therapeutic equivalent. More recently, some plans have applied reference prices to inpatient orthopedic surgery, outpatient arthroscopy, and imaging and laboratory services. The eighth and final strategy we discuss in the report is enrolling eligible children of state employees in the Children's Health Insurance Program, or CHIP. The Affordable Care Act provides states with the option to extend eligibility for CHIP to children of public employees if certain requirements are met, which we detail in the report. States stand to save money that currently goes to employees' health benefits by adopting this option, while giving their lower-income employees access to comprehensive, relatively low-cost health coverage. To close, states are responsible for purchasing and managing the health plans of more than 2.5 million employees and their families. This spending constitutes a substantial portion of states' overall healthcare expenditures. How they manage their employee benefits affects states' fiscal health, their ability to recruit and retain qualified staff to deliver critical public services, and state employees' physical, mental, and financial well-being. It is critical that state policymakers make evidence-based decisions by, among other strategies, comparing themselves to their peers. The benchmark data presented in this report on premiums, premium contribution arrangements, and cost-sharing arrangements, as well as information on steps states can take to influence costs, provide a solid base of evidence for such decision-making. Next slide. As we close, I want to quickly let you know about past and future research from our project. Last month, we released three parts of our series on state healthcare spending, with reports on state prison healthcare spending, state Medicaid spending, and enrollment trends, and a snapshot of states' key health indicators, helping to lay out some of the context underlying spending differences. All of these reports can be found online at pewtrusts.org/healthcare spending, which is all one word. In the coming months, we'll publish 50-state data for other spending areas, including CHIP, mental health services, and substance abuse treatment and prevention, as I mentioned at the beginning. We hope you'll keep an eye out for these releases. I look forward to taking your questions, and I will give the floor back to Ruth.
Thanks, Matt. That was fantastic information. We really appreciate it. I don't know if any others on the phone have read the full report, but it is a great read, very interesting work that you've done. We would like to take some time for questions or discussion that the states may have. So if you would remember to, unless you're asking a question, keep your phone on mute to minimize distraction. But we would take, Matt would take some questions now if anyone has questions about what he's presented today or anything in the study, if you've read it in advance. I might start, Matt. I had a question for you. On reference-based pricing, do you know how many states are using some of these strategies, like wellness and reference-based pricing, and some of the strategies you had put forward?
Doing an accounting of which states were using these strategies was out of the scope of the research, so we didn't we don't have that in terms of, you know, the number of states doing well who employ wellness programs or the number of states using reference pricing or so on. In certain cases, like both of those, though, we do highlight states that have reported sort of success and kind of promising outcomes in terms of their use of those. So in the case of reference pricing, we talk about California and CalPERS' use of it with orthopedic surgery and some of the savings that they've been able to achieve. And for wellness programs, we point to North Carolina's early adoption of its wellness program. But unfortunately, we don't have that count of states for these various strategies.
Okay.
I should say for some others, you know, in my discussion of how states treat their pre-Medicare retirees in terms of contribution arrangements or the number of tiers states employ, we do have that 50-state data, and we include that in the report. So in some cases, we have the 50-state breakouts and not just who's doing what, but how states differ. But in other cases, we do not.
Okay. Other questions we might have from members of the audience?
Yeah, this is Kurt Casual from the state of Maine. I'm curious whether you have any information on the prevalence of underlying ACOs that are in these health plans and how that might have had a positive impact on what some of the figures that you show are, you know, in terms of what the cost of the programs are and the premium structures?
Sure. It's a good question. We did not look specifically at that. You know, what we were trying to do was to create a series of normalized benchmarks that would be comparable across states. So what we sought to do was use, you know, we excluded certain employees, like local employees and education employees, which differ depending on whether or not they're considered state employees from states. And we used certain definitions as far as what constituted the plans. In terms of who the carriers were or kind of plan design makeup beyond some of the elements I discussed, like tiers and cost sharing and actuarial values and so on, we did not look at that question specifically. But it's certainly a good one and could be something that we could look at in the future.
We have another question about tobacco surcharge, and maybe if you haven't studied this in your presentation, Matt, maybe some other members on the call want to speak in. But do other states offer a tobacco surcharge, and is there any data on how that has helped with savings on their health plan. So feel free to chime in if your state is using a tobacco surcharge and if you found it effective. Or Matt, if you could tell us if you found any evidence of that too.
We described how states could use an, or employ a strategy like that, we did not look specifically at that. North Carolina's was broader and kind of targeted more towards weight loss. So I would certainly love to hear what other participants on the call have to say.
Are there any states who would volunteer to talk about their tobacco surcharge usage?
Go ahead.
South Dakota does have a tobacco surcharge.
Do you have any data on how effective you found that to be?
Well, the data we have, it is self-reporting, and there's no way to, we don't deploy any method to validate it other than employee self-disclosure. It appears that based on the overall prevalence of tobacco use in the state, based on CDC data, that we are seeing underreporting of tobacco use. I think we had about 7% in our most recent enrollment who voluntarily disclosed tobacco use, and the overall prevalence among adults is about 20% here.
Great. Yeah, that's great information. Any other states who would like to talk about that? Okay, thanks for stepping forward, South Dakota. We appreciate it. What other questions do you have for Matt or for other members on the phone?
Was there any consideration in this study as to the impact on plan design and cost sharing based on whether or not state government employees were represented by a public employee labor union?
Whether or not employees were represented by a union was not a variable that we looked at in terms of differences in cost sharing or actuarial value. We would leave that to individual states who know their circumstances best to be able to compare with other states. But in terms of the cost sharing, as I mentioned, the average was an actuarial value of 92%, which would designate it as a platinum plan if you compared it to the health insurance exchanges, which is not a perfect comparison because that measure is really geared towards the individual marketplace, but is just a point of context. That said, most states, I believe almost every state, had an actuarial value of 80% or above, and 80% would be designated as gold. So while there was variation with respect to average actuarial values, and to be clear, the averages we report are averages across plans weighted by enrollment in those plans. But while there is some variation, there wasn't, I guess there might have been more, or some people might have expected to see more. In that regard, the range was fairly narrow. But whether or not the impact that union membership might have had on that was out of the scope of our research.
Thanks, Matt. How about other questions? Anyone else on the phone have any other questions? Questions about high deductible health care? I know you started your presentation with that and the prevalence and how states have been slow to adopt it. Any questions out there? Matt, how many states did you find had started to introduce high deductible plans?
Well, as you know, high deductible health plans, according to IRS regulations, can have a deductible of 1,200 an annual deductible of $1,250 a year is sort of the line that they use. In our research and our work with Milliman, we made the line $1,500 a year. And what we found is that in 2013, 19 states had offered those plans, and that was up from 16 states in 2011. But interestingly, the enrollment in those plans, even in states that offered them, was low. So it was a median of 7% of enrollees in those plans in states that did offer them, and nationwide, only 4% of employees had enrolled in plans with deductibles of $1,500 or higher. And of course, that average is pulled down by including states that don't even offer them. But that was an interesting finding for us that states have not only been slow to offer such plans, but to the extent that they do, and in states where they do, the take-up rate doesn't seem to be very high.
I might agree with the take-up rates. This is we just offered a plan in Nebraska, and for an introductory year, picked up 300 individuals participating in the plan, which actually exceeded our expectations. But that really, we saw a lot of similar evidence to what you're talking about. Any other questions for Matt, or any other questions for anyone else on the phone?
Can you? Or is there any information on how many states offered multiple health plans within their programs?
That is, Milliman does include that information as part of their database. We did not include that number for every state in the report in terms of the number of plans offered. Most states tended to be, I believe, in the range of 3 to 5 plans that they would offer, and in some cases, states offered quite a bit more than that. But that tended to be driven by the use of regional HMOs. So there wasn't a lot of variability in the number of plans that states offered. I think a handful might have offered only one or two, but most, I believe, we're in the 3 to 5 range. And of course, all this applies to 2013. So some of that might have changed since then.
Other questions? Would it be beneficial to the group if we sent out, we could work with Leslie and maybe send out a survey of our own members asking some questions about how many use tobacco surcharge, wellness, reference-based pricing, multiple health plans, if we need follow-up information. If you had some questions that you wanted us to ask the whole group, we could format a survey among our members, of course not to the wonderful research and scientific method that Matt has used, but just kind of an informational piece so that states would have other states to go to. On-site clinics might be another question that is of interest to states that we could put in that survey. If people are interested in that and they want to have some topics that they would like to add, we'd be happy to format that. They could just email either Leslie or myself, Ruth, Jones@nebraska.gov, and we could formulate a quick survey to ask some of these questions. Would that be helpful to the group? I might get South Dakota to answer that.
Yeah, it definitely would be.
Thank you.
Yes, ma'am.
Anything else anyone would like to ask before we conclude? Okay, I would really like to thank Matt and the Pew Charitable Trust for all the research they've done and bringing this to our attention, and especially since with the timely release of just yesterday. We really appreciate you being on the phone immediately to help us read the report and ask any questions we might have. Thank you so much, Matt, for your time today. And if you watch your email, our next two calls, we have one scheduled in a couple months, a date yet to be determined. We'll be talking more in depth about value-based healthcare and followed at the start of January with a more in-depth call on wellness. So if you have, we'll watch your calendar for those dates. Any other suggested topics you'd like us to discuss, please email those as well. So thank you for your time today, and thank you again, Matt. We appreciate everyone participating.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.